Chapter 18. When Byron reached the town, he found that he couldn't see the sheriff until noon, since the sheriff would be engaged all morning with the special grand jury. "You'll have to wait," they told him.
"Yes," Byron said, "I know how."
"Know how what?"
But he didn't answer. He left the sheriff's office and stood beneath the portico which faced the south side of the square. From the shallow flagged terrace the stone columns rose, arching, weathered, stained with generations of casual tobacco. Beneath them, steady and constant, and with a grave purposelessness, and with here and there standing motionless or talking to one another from the sides of their mouths, some youngish men, townsmen, some of whom Byron knew as clerks and young lawyers and even merchants, who had a generally identical authoritative air, like policemen in disguise, and not especially caring if the disguise hid the policeman or not, countrymen in overalls moved, with almost the air of monks in a cloister, speaking quietly among themselves of money and crops, looking quietly now and then upward at the ceiling beyond which the grand jury was preparing, behind locked doors, to take the life of a man whom few of them had ever seen to know, for having taken the life of a woman whom even fewer of them had known to see. The wagons and the dusty cars in which they'd come to town were ranked about the square, and along the streets and in and out of the stores the wives and daughters who'd come to town with them moved in clumps, slowly and also aimlessly as cattle or clouds. Byron stood there for quite a while, motionless, not leaning against anything. A small man who had lived in the town 7 years, yet whom even fewer of the country people than knew, either the murderer or the murdered, knew by name or habit. Byron wasn't conscious of this. He didn't care now, though a week ago it would have been different. Then he wouldn't have stood here where any man could look at him and perhaps recognize him. Byron Bunch, that weeded another man's laid-by crop without any havers. The fellow that took care of another man's whore while the other fellow was busy making $1,000 and got nothing for it. Byron Bunch that protected her good name when the woman that owned the good name and the man she'd given it to had both thrown it away. That got the other fellow's bastard born in peace and quiet and at Byron Bunch's expense and heard a baby cry once for his pay. Got nothing for it except permission to fetch the other fellow back to her as soon as he got done collecting $1,000. And Byron wasn't needed any more. Byron Bunch. Now I can go away, he thought. He began to breathe deep. He could feel himself breathing deep, as if each time his insides were afraid that next breath wouldn't be able to give far enough and that something terrible would happen, and that all the time he could look down at himself, breathing, at his chest, and see no movement at all, like when dynamite first begins, gathers itself for the now, now, now. The shape of the outside of the stick doesn't change, that the people who passed and looked at him could see no change. A small man you wouldn't look at twice, that you'd never believe he'd done what he'd done and felt what he'd felt, who believed that out there at the mill on a Saturday afternoon, alone, the chance to be hurt couldn't have found him. He was walking among the people. I gotta go somewhere, he thought. He could walk in time to that. I got to go somewhere. That would get him along. He was still saying it when he reached the boarding house. His room faced the street. Before he realized that he had begun to look toward it, he was looking away. I might see somebody reading or smoking in the window, he thought. He entered the hall. After the bright morning, he couldn't see at once. He could smell wet linoleum, soap. It's still Monday, he thought. I'd forgot that. Maybe it's next Monday. That's what it seems like it ought to be. He didn't call. After a while, he could see better. He could hear the mop in the back of the hall, or maybe the kitchen. Then, against the rectangle of light, which was the rear door, also open, he saw Mrs. Beard's head leaning out, then her body in full silhouette, advancing up the hall.
"Well," she said, "it's Mr. Byron Bunch. Mr. Byron Bunch."
"Yes'm," he said, thinking only a fat lady that never had much more trouble than a mopping pail would hold ought not to try to be. Again, he couldn't think of the word that Hightower would know, would use, without having to think of it. "It's like I not only can't do anything without getting him mixed up in it, I can't even think without him to help me out."
"Yes'm,"
he said. And then he stood there, not even able to tell her that he'd come to say goodbye. "Maybe I ain't," he thought. "I reckon when a fellow's lived in one room for 7 years, he ain't going to get moved in one day. Well, I reckon that ain't going to interfere with her renting out this room.
I reckon I owe you a little room rent," he said.
She looked at him, a hard, comfortable face, not unkind either.
"Rent for what?" she said. "I thought you settled, decided to tent for the summer."
She looked at him. Then she told him. She did it gently, delicately, considering.
"I done already collected the rent for that room."
"Oh," he said.
"Yes, I see. Yes."
He looked quietly up the scoured linoleum-stripped stairway, scuffed bare by the aid of his own feet. When the new linoleum was put down 3 years ago, he'd been the first of the boarders to mount upon it.
"Oh," he said. "Well, I reckon I better..."
She answered that, too, immediately, not unkind. "I tended to that. I put everything you left in your grip. It's back in my room. If you want to go up and look for yourself, though."
"No, I reckon you got it. Well, I reckon I..."
She was watching him.
"You man," she said. "It ain't a wonder women folks get impatient with you. You can't even know your own limits for devilment. Which ain't more than I can measure on a pin at that. I reckon if it wasn't for getting some woman mixed up in it to help ye, you'd every one of you be drug hollering into heaven before you was 10 years old.
I reckon you ain't got any call to say anything against her," he said.
"No more I ain't. I don't need to. Don't no other woman need to that's going to. I ain't saying that it ain't been women that's done most of the talking. But if you had more than man sense, you would know that women don't mean anything when they talk. It's men folks that take talking serious. It ain't any woman that believes hard against you and her. Because it ain't any woman but knows that she ain't had any reason to have to be bad with you, even discounting that baby. Or any other man right now. She never had to. Ain't you and that preacher and every other man that knows about her already done everything for her that she could think to want? What's she need to be bad for? Tell me that."
"Yes," Byron says. He wasn't looking at her now.
"I just come..."
She answered that too before it was spoken.
"I reckon you'll be leaving us soon."
She was watching him.
"What have they done this morning at the courthouse?"
"I don't know. They ain't finished yet."
"I bound that too. They'll take as much time and trouble and county money as they can, cleaning up what us women would have cleaned up in 10 minutes Saturday night. For being such a fool. Not that Jefferson will miss him. Can't get along without him, but being fool enough to believe that killing a woman will do a man any more good than killing a man would a woman. I reckon I'll let the other one go now.
Yes'm. I reckon so.
And they believed for a while that he helped do it. And so they'll give him that $1,000 to show it ain't any hard feelings. Then they can get married. That's about right, Ann.
Yes'm.
He could feel her watching him, not unkindly. And so I reckon you'll be leaving us. I reckon you kind of feel you've wore out, Jefferson, don't you?
Something like that.
I reckon I'll move on. Well, Jefferson's a good town, but it ain't so good but what a footloose man like you can find in another one. Enough devilment and trouble to keep him occupied, too. You can leave your grip here until you're ready for it, if you want.
He waited until noon and after. He waited until he believed that the sheriff had finished his dinner. Then he went to the sheriff's home. He wouldn't come in. He waited at the door until the sheriff came out, and the fat man with little wise eyes like bits of mica embedded in his fat, still face. They went aside into the shade of a tree in the yard. There was no seat there. Neither did they squat on their heels, as by ordinary, and they were both country-bred, they would have done. The sheriff listened quietly to the man, the quiet little man who for 7 years had been a minor mystery to the town, and who had been for 7 days well-nigh a public outrage and affront. "I see," the sheriff said. "You think the time has come to get him married?"
"I don't know. That's his business and hers.
I reckon he'd better go out and see her, though. I reckon now is the time for that. You can send a deputy with him. I told her he'd come out there this evening. What they do then is her business and his'n. Ain't mine."
"Sure," the sheriff said, "it ain't yourn."
He was looking at the other's profile. "What do you aim to do now, Byron?"
"I don't know."
His foot moved slowly upon the earth. He was watching it. "I've been thinking about going up to Memphis. I've been thinking about it for a couple of years. I might do that. There ain't nothing in these little towns."
"Sure. Memphis ain't a bad town for them that like city life. Of course, you ain't got any family to have to drag around and hamper you. I reckon if I'd been a single man 10 years ago, I'd have done that, too. Been better off, maybe."
"You're figuring on leaving right away, I reckon."
"Soon, I reckon."
He looked up, then down again. He said, "I quit out at the mill this morning."
"So," the sheriff said, "I figured you hadn't walked all the way in since 12 and aimed to get back out there by 1 o'clock.
Well, it looks like..."
He ceased. He knew that by night the grand jury would have indicted Christmas, and Brown, or Birch, would be a free agent, save for his bond to appear as a witness at next month's court. But even his presence wouldn't be absolutely essential, since Christmas had made no denial, and the sheriff believed that he would plead guilty in order to save his neck. "And it won't do no harm anyway to throw the scare of God into that darn fellow once in his life," he thought. He said, "I reckon that can be fixed. Of course, like you say, I will have to send a deputy with him, even if he ain't gonna run, so long as he has any hope of getting some of that reward money. And provided he don't know what he's going to meet when he gets there."
"He don't know that yet."
"No," Byron said. "He don't know that. He don't know that she's in Jefferson."
"So I reckon I'll just send him out there with a deputy. Not tell him why, just send him out there.
Unless you want to take him yourself."
"No," Byron said, "no, no."
But he didn't move.
"I'll just do that. You'll be gone by that time, I reckon. I'll just send a deputy with him.
Will 4 o'clock do? It'll be fine. It'll be kind of you. It'll be kindness.
Sure.
Lots of folks beside me have been good to us since she come to Jefferson. Well, I ain't gonna say goodbye. I reckon Jefferson will see you again someday. Never known a man yet to live here a while and then leave it for good. Except maybe that fella in the jail yonder. But he'll plead guilty, I reckon. Save his neck. Take it out of Jefferson, though, anyway. It's right hard on that old lady that thinks she's his grandmother. The old man was downtown when I come home, hollering and ranting, calling folks cowards because they wouldn't take him out of jail right then and there and lynch him. He began to chuckle heavily. Hey, you better be careful, or Percy Grimm will get him with that army of his. He sobered. It's right hard on her, on women. He looked at Byron's profile. It's been right hard on a lot of us. Well, you come back someday soon. Maybe Jefferson will treat you better next time. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, hidden, he sees the car come up and stop, and the deputy and the man whom he knew by the name of Brown get out and approach the cabin. Brown isn't handcuffed now, and Byron watches them reach the cabin and sees the deputy push Brown forward and into the door. Then the door closes behind Brown, and the deputy sits on the step and takes a sack of tobacco from his pocket. Byron rises to his feet. I can go now, he thinks. Now I can go. His hiding place is a clump of shrubbery on the lawn where the house once stood. On the opposite side of the clump, hidden from the cabin and the road both, the mule is tethered. Lashed behind the worn saddle is a battered yellow suitcase which isn't leather. He mounts the mule and turns it into the road. He doesn't look back. The mild red road goes on beneath the slanting and peaceful afternoon, mounting a hill. Well, I can bear a hill, he thinks. I can bear a hill. Man can. It's peaceful and still, familiar with 7 years. It seems like a man can just about bear anything. He can even bear what he never done. He can even bear the thinking how some things are just more than he can bear. He can even bear it that if he could just give down and cry, he wouldn't do it. He can even bear it not to look back, even when he knows that looking back or not looking back won't do him any good. The hill rises, cresting. He's never seen the sea, and so he thinks, it's like the edge of nothing. Like once I passed it, I would just ride right off into nothing. Where trees would look like and be called by something else except trees, and men would look like and be called by something else except folks. And Byron Bunch, he wouldn't even have to be or not be Byron Bunch. Byron Bunch and his mule. Not anything with falling fast until they'd take fire, like the Reverend Hightower says about them rocks running so fast in space that they take fire and burn up, and there ain't even a cinder to have to hit the ground. But then, from beyond the hill crest, there begins to rise that which he knows is there. The trees, which are trees. The terrific and tedious distance, which, being moved by blood, he must compass forever and ever between two inescapable horizons of the implacable earth. Steadily they rise, not portentous, not threatful. That's it.
They are oblivious of him. Don't know and don't care, he thinks. Like they're saying, all right, you say you suffer, all right. But in the first place, all we got is your naked word for it. And in the second place, you just say that you're Byron Bunch. And in the third place, you're just the one that calls yourself Byron Bunch today, now, this minute. Well, he thinks, if that's all it is, I reckon I might as well have the pleasure of not being able to bear looking back, too. He halts the mule and turns in the saddle. He didn't realize that he's come so far and that the crest is so high. Like a shallow bowl, the once broad domain of what was 70 years ago a plantation house lies beneath him, between him and the opposite ridge upon which is Jefferson. But the plantation is broken now by random Negro cabins and garden patches and dead fields erosion-gutted and choked with blackjack and sassafras and persimmon and briar. But in the exact center, the clump of oaks still stand as they stood when the house was built, though now there's no house among them. From here, he can't even see the scars of the fire. He couldn't even tell where it used to stand if it weren't for the oaks and the position of the ruined stable and the cabin beyond. The cabin, toward which he's looking. It stands full and quiet in the afternoon sun, almost toy-like. Like a toy, the deputy sits on the step. Then, as Byron watches, a man appears as though by magic at the rear of it, already running. In the act of running out from the rear of the cabin while the unsuspecting deputy sits quiet and motionless on the front step. For a while longer, Byron, too, sits motionless, half-turned in the saddle, and watches the tiny figure flee on across the barren slope behind the cabin, toward the woods. Then a cold, hard wind seems to blow through him. It is at once violent and peaceful, blowing hard away like chaff or trash or dead leaves, all the desire and the despair and the hopelessness and the tragic and vain imagining, too. With the very blast of it, he seems to feel himself rush back and empty again, without anything in him now which hadn't been there 2 weeks ago, before he ever saw her. The desire of this moment is more than desire. It's conviction, quiet and assured. Before he is aware that his brain has telegraphed his hand, he's turned the mule from the road and is galloping along the ridge which parallels the running man's course when he entered the woods. He hasn't even named the man's name to himself. He doesn't speculate at all upon where the man is going and why. It doesn't once enter his head that Brown is fleeing again, as he himself had predicted. If he thought about it at all, he probably believed that Brown was engaged, after his own peculiar fashion, in some thoroughly legitimate business having to do with his and Lena's departure. But he wasn't thinking about that at all. He wasn't thinking about Lena at all. She was as completely out of his mind as if he'd never seen her face nor heard her name. He's thinking, I took care of his woman for him, and I borned his child for him, and now there's one more thing I can do for him. I can't marry them because I ain't a minister, and I may not catch him because he's got a start on me, and I may not can whip him if I do, because he's bigger than me. But I can try it. I can try to do it. When the deputy called for him at the jail, Brown asked at once where they were going. Visiting, the deputy told him. Brown held back, watching the deputy with his handsome, spuriously bold face. I don't want to visit nobody here. I'm a stranger here. You'd be strange anywhere you was at, the deputy said, even at home. Come on. I'm an American citizen,
Brown said. I reckon I got my rights, even if I don't wear no tin star on my galluses. Sure, deputy said. That's what I'm doing now, helping you get your rights. Brown's face lighted. It was a flash. Have they? Are they going to pay that reward? Sure. I'm going to take you to the place myself right now, where if you're going to get any reward, you'll get it. Brown sobered, but he moved, though he still watched the deputy suspiciously. This hair is a funny way to go about it, he said. Keeping me shut up in jail while them bastards tries to beat me out of it. I reckon the bastard ain't been whelped yet that can beat you at anything, the deputy said. Come on, they're waiting on us. They emerged from the jail. In the sunlight, Brown blinked, looking this way and that. Then he jerked his head up, looking back over his shoulder with that horse-like movement. The car was waiting at the curb. Brown looked at the car and then at the deputy, quite sober, quite wary. Where are we going in the car? He said. Wasn't too far for me to walk to the courthouse this morning. Watt sent the car to help bring back the rewardian, the deputy said. Get in. Brown grunted. He done got mighty particular about my comfort all of a sudden. Car to ride in, no handcuffs, just one darn fella to keep me from running away. I ain't keeping you from running, the deputy said. He paused in the act of starting the car. You won't run now? Brown looked at him, glaring, sullen, outraged, suspicious. I see. He said, that's his trick. Trick me into running and then click that $1,000 himself. How much of it did he promise you? Me? I'm going to get the same as you. To a cent. For a moment longer, Brown glared at the deputy. He cursed, pointless, in a weak, violent way. Come on, he said. Let's go if we're going. They drove out to the scene of the fire and the murder. At steady, almost timed intervals, Brown jerked his head up and back with that movement of a free mule running in front of a car in a narrow road. What are we going out here for? To get your reward, the deputy said. Where am I going to get it? In that cabin yonder. It's waiting for you there. Brown looked about, at the blackened embers which had once been a house, at the blank cabin in which he'd lived for 4 months, sitting weathered and quiet in the sunlight. His face was quite grave, quite alert. There's something funny about this. If Kennedy thinks he can trample on my rights just because he wears a darn little tin star. Get on, the deputy said. If you don't like the reward, I'll be waiting to take you back to jail any time you want. Just any time you want. He pushed Brown on, opening the cabin door and pushing him into it and closing the door behind him and sitting on the step. Brown heard the door close behind him. He was still moving forward. Then, in the midst of one of those quick, jerking, all-embracing looks, as if his eyes couldn't wait to take in the room, he stopped, dead still. Lena, on the cot, watched the white scar beside his mouth vanish completely, as if the ebb of blood behind it had snatched the scar in passing like a rag from a clothesline. She didn't speak at all. She just lay there, propped on the pillows, watching him with her sober eyes, in which there was nothing at all—joy, surprise, reproach, love.
while over his face passed shock, astonishment, outrage, and then downright terror, each one mocking in turn at the telltale little white scar, while ceaselessly here and there about the empty room went his harried and desperate eyes. She watched him, herd them by will, like two terrified beasts, and drive them up to meet her own. "Well, well," he said. "Well, well, well. It's Lena." She watched him, holding his eyes up to hers like two beasts about to break, as if he knew that when they broke this time, he'd never catch them, turn them again, and that he himself would be lost. She could almost watch his mind, casting this way and that, ceaseless, harried, terrified, seeking words which his voice, his tongue, could speak. "Well, if it ain't Lena." "Yes, sir." "So, you got my message. As soon as I got here, I sent you a message last month, since I got settled down, and I thought it got lost. It was a fellow, I didn't know what his name was, but he said he'd take... He didn't look reliable, but I had to trust him, but I thought when I gave him the $10 for you to travel on that he..." His voice died somewhere behind his desperate eyes. Yet still she could watch his mind darting and darting, as without pity, without anything at all, she watched him with her grave, unwinking, unbearable gaze, watched him fumble and flee and tack, until at last all that remained in him of pride, of what sorry pride the desire for justification was, fled from him, left him naked. Then, for the first time, she spoke. Her voice was quiet, unruffled, cool. "Come over here," she said. "Come on. I ain't gonna let him bite you." When he moved, he approached on tiptoe. She saw that, though she was now no longer watching him. She knew that, just as she knew that he was now standing with a kind of clumsy and diffident awe above her and the sleeping child. But she knew that it wasn't at and because of the child. She knew that in that sense he hadn't even seen the child. She could still see, feel, his mind darting and darting. "He's going to make out like he wasn't afraid," she thought. "He'll have no more shame than to lie about being afraid. Just as he had no more shame than to be afraid because he lied." "Well, well," he said. "So, there it is, sure enough." "Yes," she said. "Will you sit down?" The chair which Hightower had drawn up was still beside the cot. He'd already remarked it. "She had it all ready for me," he thought. Again he cursed, soundless, badgered, furious. "Them bastards. Them bastards." But his face was quite smooth when he sat down. "Yes, sir. Here we are again. Seems I'd planned it. I would have had it all fixed up, ready for you. Only I've been so busy lately. Which reminds me..." Again he made that abrupt, mule-like, back-looking movement of the head. She wasn't looking at him. She said, "There's a preacher here. That's already come to see me." "Well, that's fine," he said. His voice was loud, hearty. Yet the heartiness, like the timbre, seemed to be as impermanent as the sound of the words, vanishing, leaving nothing. Not even a definitely stated thought in the ear or the belief. "That's just fine,"
Soon as I get caught up with all this business... He jerked his arm in a gesture vague, embracing, looking at her. His face was smooth and blank. His eyes were bland, alert, secret. Yet behind them there lurked still that quality harried and desperate. But she wasn't looking at him.
What kind of work are you doing now? At the planing mill?
He watched her.
No, I quit that.
His eyes watched her. It was as though they weren't his eyes, had no relation to the rest of him, what he did and what he said.
Slaving like a darn nigger, 10 hours a day? I got something on the string now that means money. Not no little piddling 15 cents an hour. And when I get it, soon as I get a few little details cleared up, then you and me'll...
Hard, intent, secret. The eyes watched her, her lowered face in profile. Again she heard that faint, abrupt sound as he jerked his head up and back.
And that reminds me...
She hadn't moved. She said...
When will it be, Lucas?
Then she could hear, feel, utter stillness, utter silence.
When will what be?
You know, like you said, back home.
It was all right for just me, I never minded.
But it's different now.
I reckon I got a right to worry now.
Oh, that, he said.
That? Don't you worry about that. Just let me get this here business cleaned up and get my hands on that money. It's mine by right. I can't near a bastard one of them.
He stopped. His voice had begun to rise as though he'd forgot where he was and had been thinking aloud. He lowered it. He said,
You just leave it to me. Don't you worry none. I ain't never give you no reason yet to worry, have I? Tell me that.
No, I never worried. I knowed I could depend on you.
Sure you knowed it. And these here bastards, these here...
He'd risen from the chair.
Which reminds me...
She neither looked up nor spoke while he stood above her with those eyes harried, desperate, and importunate. It was as if she held him there and that she knew it. And that she released him by her own will, deliberately.
I reckon you are right busy now, then.
For a fact, I am.
With all I got to bother me and them bastards.
She was looking at him now. She watched him as he looked at the window in the rear wall. Then he looked back at the closed door behind him. Then he looked at her, at her grave face, which had either nothing in it, or everything, all knowledge. He lowered his voice.
I got enemies here. Folks that don't want me to get what I done earned. So I'm going to...
Again, it was though she held him, forcing him to, trying him with... That final lie at which even his sorry dregs of pride revolted. Held him neither with rods nor cords, but with something against which his lying blew trivial as leaves of trash. But she said nothing at all. She just watched him as he went on tiptoe to the window and opened it without a sound. Then he looked at her. Perhaps he thought that he was safe then,
that he could get out the window before she could touch him with a physical hand. Or perhaps it was some sorry tag end of shame, as a while ago it had been pride. Because he looked at her, stripped naked for the instant of verbiage and deceit. His voice was not much louder than a whisper. "It's a man. Outside. In front. Waiting for me." Then he was gone. Through the window. Without a sound, in a single motion, almost like a long snake. From beyond the window she heard a single faint sound as he began to run. Then only did she move, and then but to sigh once, profoundly. "Now I gotta get up again," she said, aloud. When Brown emerges from the woods onto the railroad right-of-way, he's panting. It isn't with fatigue, though the distance which he's covered in the last 20 minutes is almost 2 miles, and the going wasn't smooth. Rather, it's the snarling and malevolent breathing of a fleeing animal. While he stands looking both ways along the empty track, his face, his expression, is that of an animal fleeing alone, desiring no fellow aid, clinging to its solitary dependence upon its own muscles alone, and which, in the pause to renew breath, hates every tree and grass blade in sight, as if it were a live enemy, hates the very earth it rests upon, and the very air it needs to renew breathing. He struck the railroad within a few hundred yards of the point at which he aimed. This is the crest of a grade where the northbound freights slow to a terrific and crawling gait of almost less than that of a walking man. A short distance ahead of him, the twin bright threads appear to have been cut short off, as though with scissors. For a while he stands just within the screen of woods beside the right-of-way, still hidden. He stands like a man in brooding and desperate calculation, as if he sought in his mind for some last desperate cast in a game already lost. After standing for a moment longer in an attitude of listening, he turns and runs again, through the woods and paralleling the track. He seems to know exactly where he's going. He comes presently upon a path and follows it, still running, and emerges into a clearing in which a Negro cabin sits. He approaches the front, walking now. On the porch, an old Negro woman is sitting, smoking a pipe, her head wrapped in a white cloth. Brown isn't running, but he is breathing fast, heavily. He quiets it to speak. "Hi, Annie," he says. "Who's here?" The old negress removes the pipe. "I's here. Who wanna know?" "Well, I got to send a message back to town in a hurry." He holds his breathing down to talk. "Yeah, I'll pay. Ain't there somebody here that can take it?"
"If it's all that rush, you better tend to it yourself."
"I'll pay, I tell you," he says. He speaks with a kind of raging patience, holding his voice, his breathing down. "$1, if he just goes quick enough. Ain't there somebody here wants to make $1? Some of the boys?"
The old woman smokes, watching him. With an aged and inscrutable midnight face, she seems to contemplate him with a detachment almost godlike, but not at all benign.
$1 cash.
He makes a gesture indescribable of hurry and leashed rage and something like despair. He's about to turn away when the negress speaks again.
"Ain't nobody here but me and the two little ones.
I reckon they'd be too little for you. Brown turns back. How little? I just want somebody that can take a note to the sheriff in a hurry and... The sheriff? Then you come to the wrong place. I ain't gonna have none of mine monkeying around no sheriff. I done had one nigga thought he knowed a sheriff well enough to go and visit with him. He ain't never come back neither. You look somewhere else. But Brown is already moving away. He doesn't run at once. He hasn't yet thought about running again. For the moment, he can't think at all. His rage and impotence is now almost ecstatic. He seems to muse now upon a sort of timeless and beautiful infallibility in his unpredictable frustrations. As though somehow the very fact that he should be so consistently supplied with them elevates him somehow above the petty human hopes and desires which they abrogate and negative. Hence the negress has to shout twice at him before he hears and turns. She said nothing. She hasn't moved. She merely shouted. She says, "Here one will take it for you." Standing beside the porch now, materialized apparently from thin air, is a negro who may be either a grown imbecile or a hulking youth. His face is black, still, also quite inscrutable. They stand looking at one another. Or rather, Brown looks at the negro. He can't tell if the negro is looking at him or not. And that, too, seems somehow right and fine and in keeping, that his final hope and resort should be a beast that doesn't appear to have enough ratiocinative power to find the town, let alone any given individual in it. Again, Brown makes an indescribable gesture. He's almost running now back toward the porch, pawing at his shirt pocket. "I want you to take a note to town and bring me back an answer," he says. "Can you do it?" But he doesn't listen for a reply. He's taken from his shirt a scrap of soiled paper and a chewed pencil stub, and bending over the edge of the porch, he writes, laborious and hurried, while the negress watches him. "Mr. Watt Kennedy, dear sir, please give bearer my reward money for Captain Murder Xmas. Wrap it up in paper for giving it to bearer yours truly." He doesn't sign it. He snatches it up, glaring at it, while the negress watches him. He glares at the dingy and innocent paper, at the labored and hurried penciling in which he'd succeeded for an instant in snaring his whole soul and life, too. Then he claps it down and writes, "Not signed, but all right, you know who," and folds it and gives it to the negro. "Take it to the sheriff. Not to anybody else. You reckon you can find him?"
"If the sheriff don't find him first," the old negress says, "give it to him. He'll find him if he's above ground. Get your dollar and go on, boy."
The negro had started away. He stops. He just stands there, saying nothing, looking at nothing. On the porch, the negress sits, smoking, looking down at the white man's weak, wolf-like face, a face handsome, plausible, but drawn now by a fatigue more than physical, into a spent and vulpine mask.
"I thought you was in a hurry," she says.
"Yes," Brown says. He takes a coin from his pocket. "Here, and if you bring me back the answer to that inside of an hour, I'll give you 5 more like it."
"Get on, nigger," the woman says. "You ain't got all day. You want the answer brought back here?"
For a moment longer, Brown looks at her. Then again, caution, shame, all flee from him. "No, not here. Bring it to the top of the grade yonder. Walk up the track until I call to you. I'll be watching you all the time, too. Don't you forget that. You hear?"
"You needn't to worry," the negro says. "He'll get there with it and get back with the answer.
if don't nothing stop him. Get on, boy. The Negro goes on, but something does stop him before he's gone a half mile. It's another white man leading a mule. Why? Byron says, where'd you see him? Just now. Up yon at the house. The white man goes on, leading the mule. The Negro looks after him. He didn't show the white man the note because the white man didn't ask to see it. Perhaps the reason the white man didn't ask to see the note was that the white man didn't know that he had a note. Perhaps, the Negro is thinking this, because for a while his face mirrors something terrific and subterraneous. Then it clears. He shouts. The white man turns, halting. He ain't down now, the Negro shouts. He say he gone up to the railroad grade to wait. Much obliged, the white man says. The Negro goes on.
Brown returned to the track. He wasn't running now. He was saying to himself, he won't do it. He can't do it. I know, he can't find him, can't get it, bring it back. He called no names, thought no names. It seemed to him now that they were all just shapes, like chessmen, the Negro, the sheriff, the money, all unpredictable and without reason, moved here and there by an opponent who could read his moves before he made them, and who created spontaneous rules which he, and not the opponent, must follow. It was for the time being even beyond despair as he turned from the rails and entered the underbrush near the crest of the grade. He moved now without haste, gauging his distance as though there were nothing else in the world, or in his life at least, save that. He chose his place and sat down, hidden from the track, but where he himself could see it. Only I know he won't do it, he thinks. I don't even expect it. If I was to see him coming back with the money in his hand, I wouldn't believe it. Wouldn't be for me. I'd know that. I'd know it was a mistake. I'd say to him, you go on, you are looking for somebody else beside me. You ain't looking for Lucas Birch. No, sir. Lucas Birch don't deserve that money, that reward. He never done nothing to get it. No, sir. He begins to laugh, squatting, motionless, his spent face bent, laughing. Yes, sir. All Lucas Birch wanted was justice. Just justice. Not that he told them bastards the murderer's name and where to find him, only they wouldn't try. They never tried because they would have had to give Lucas Birch some money. Justice. Then he says aloud in a harsh, tearful voice, justice. That was all. Just my rights. And them bastards with their little tin stars, all sworn every one of them on oath to protect an American citizen. He says it harshly, almost crying with rage and despair and fatigue. I'll be dog if it ain't enough to make a man turn downright Bolshevik. Thus he hears no sound at all, until Byron speaks directly behind him. Get up onto your feet. It doesn't last long. Byron knew that it wasn't going to, but he didn't hesitate. He just crept up until he could see the other, where he stopped, looking at the crouching and unworn figure. You're bigger than me, Byron thought, but I don't care. You've had every other advantage of me, and I don't care about that neither. You done throwed away twice inside of 9 months what I ain't had in 35 years. And now I'm going to get the hell beat out of me, and I don't care about that neither. It doesn't last long. Brown, whirling, takes advantage of his astonishment even.
He didn't believe that any man catching his enemy sitting would give him a chance to get on his feet, even if the enemy weren't the larger of the two. He wouldn't have done it himself. And the fact that the smaller man did do it, when he wouldn't have, was worse than insult, it was ridicule. So he fought with even a more savage fury than it would have if Byron had sprung upon his back without warning. With the blind and desperate valor of a starved and cornered rat, he fought. It lasted less than 2 minutes. Then Byron was lying quietly among the broken and trampled undergrowth, bleeding quietly about the face, hearing the underbrush crashing on, ceasing, fading into silence. Then he's alone. He feels no particular pain now, but better than that, he feels no haste, no urgency to do anything or go anywhere. He just lies bleeding and quiet, knowing that after a while will be time enough to re-enter the world and time. He doesn't even wonder where Brown has gone. He doesn't have to think about Brown now. Again, his mind is filled with still shapes like discarded and fragmentary toys of childhood, piled indiscriminate and gathering quiet dust in a forgotten closet. Brown, Lena Grove, Hightower, Byron Bunch, all like small objects which had never been alive, which he'd played with in childhood, then broken and forgot. He's lying so when he hears the train whistle for a crossing a half mile away. This rouses him. This is the world and time, too. He sits up slowly, tentatively. Anyway, I ain't broke anything, he thinks. I mean, he ain't broke anything that belongs to me. It's getting late. It's time now, with distance moving in it. Yes, I'll have to be moving. I'll have to get on so I can find me something else to meddle with. The train is coming nearer. Already the stroke of the engine is shortened and become heavier as it begins to feel the grade. Presently he can see the smoke. He seeks in his pocket for a handkerchief. He has none. So he tears the tail from his shirt and dabs in his face gingerly, listening to the short, blasting reports of the locomotive exhaust just over the grade. He moves to the edge of the undergrowth where he can see the track. The engine is in sight now, almost head-on to him beneath the spaced, heavy blasts of black smoke. It has an effect of terrific no motion. Yet it does move, creeping terrifically up and over the crest of the grade. Standing now in the fringe of bushes, he watches the engine approach and pass him, laboring, crawling with the rapt and boy-like absorption, and perhaps yearning, of his country raising. It passes, his eye moves on, watching the cars as they in turn crawl up and over the crest. When for the second time that afternoon he sees a man materialize, apparently out of air, in the act of running. Even then he doesn't realize what Brown is about. He's progressed too far into peace and solitude to wonder. He just stands there and watches Brown run to the train, stooping, fleeing, and grasp the iron ladder at the end of a car and leap upward and vanish from sight, as though sucked into a vacuum. The train is beginning to increase its speed. He watches the approach of the car where Brown vanished. It passes. Clinging to the rear of it, between it and the next car, Brown stands, his face leaned out and watching the bushes. They see one another at the same moment. The two faces, the mild, nondescript, bloody one, and the lean, harried, desperate one, contorted now in a soundless shouting above the noise of the train, passing one another as though on opposite orbits, and with an effect of phantoms or apparitions. Still Byron isn't thinking. Great God in the mountain, he says with childlike and almost ecstatic astonishment. He shown us how to jump a train. He sure done that before. He isn't thinking at all. It's as though the moving wall of dingy cars were a dike beyond which the world, time, hope unbelievable and certainty incontrovertible, waited, giving him yet a little more of peace. Anyway, when the last car passes, moving fast now, the world rushes down on him like a flood, a tidal wave. It's too huge and fast for distance and time, hence no path to be retraced, leading the mule for a good way before he remembers to get on it and ride. It's as though he's already and long since outstripped himself, already waiting at the cabin until he can catch up and enter. And then I'll stand there, and I'll... He tries it again. Then I'll stand there, and I will... But he can get no further than that. He's in the road again now, approaching a wagon homeward bound from town. It's about 6 o'clock. He doesn't give up, however. Even if I can't seem to get any further than that, when I'll open the door and come in and stand there. And then I'll... Look at her. The voice speaks again. Excitement, I reckon. What? Byron says. The wagon is halted. He's right beside it. The mule's stopped, too. On the wagon seat, the man speaks again in his flat, complaining voice. Darn the luck. Just when I had to get started for home. Already late. Excitement, Byron says. What excitement? The man is looking at him. From your face, a man would say you'd been in some excitement yourself. I fell down, Byron says. What excitement in town this evening? I thought maybe you hadn't heard. About an hour ago, that nigga, Christmas, they killed him.
This ends Disc 14.